You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
You're CBS Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Okay, I promised you that, of course, we are now going to be dealing with the corruption charges that former President Jacob Zuma will have to face. And there is a very specific purpose. Yesterday, many of you absolutely loved the segment we did on Land Reform 101. And the aim here is to be as basic as possible. We can come back in a week or two and have more complicated agreements and disagreements. But I think it's very important that we all have a baseline understanding of language in law, in political discussions that are bandied about by journalists, political analysts, commentators, talk show hosts, and by you yourselves, often without precision, so that we know what we're actually talking about. So I want to invite you to call in, because this is your one chance to not pay. Otherwise, you're going to have to pay for his online course, Professor James Grant, to help you understand some of the criminal law aspects related to the case that Mtsholozi will now be facing. So the lines are going to be open. Give us a quick call. We've got him for about 20, 30 minutes or so. He's extremely busy, but he's also one of the most generous regulars on our show. 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg. Any questions you have, what is racketeering, for example, you might want to know? What does the state have to prove? What about the Shabir Sheikh case? How will that feature? Any and all questions. There's no such thing as a silly question. Make sure that by the end of this discussion with Professor Grant, you know as much as possible in terms of what is legally correct in your understanding of the corruption case that Jacob Zuma is facing. If you're in Cape Town, on 021-446-0567. James, thank you so much for making time for us. Sorry, we're a bit later than we said we'd be.
No worries. Hi, Eusebius. Good morning to the listeners.
Okay, we're going to do our normal, wonderful song and dance that you and I love doing on the radio. I'm going to be asking you the silly questions, although you always pretend that they are amazingly beautiful questions.
And they are.
And my first one is, sometimes we use in the same sentence in our reporting things like corruption, money laundering, racketeering. What are the charges that Jacob Zuma actually happens to be facing? And what's the difference between these? I don't know. Is money laundering something you do in the washing machine?
You can try, but it won't help. The main charge that he's facing, and it's important at the outset to just remind everybody that these are only the charges that he's facing in respect of conduct before he was made president. So this doesn't have anything to do with what he did while he was president and any charges that might arise out of state capture. So that's the first thing that people need to realize. And the importance of that is that one may expect that the charges arising out of state capture could be far more serious. Raymond Suttner has been making the argument, or at least raising the question, isn't what happened there treason? And there's an argument for that. Something that at first I dismissed, I must admit, because in the back of my mind I had this notion that it would always require some sort of violence. And when I thought about it, I realized that it in fact didn't. So I think treason must be on the table there. But let's set that aside, just so that people are aware that we're dealing, in fact, with the less serious offences.
Yes.
What are these? So corruption, racketeering, money laundering, and fraud are pretty much the four that he's facing. Corruption effectively is where you intentionally, now intention is required for all of these offences, with the exception of racketeering. There's the possibility of you committing racketeering negligently. So let's just start by saying all of this requires that you must have known, firstly, the facts about what it is that you supposedly did wrong. But in addition, and this seems to be what the president was aiming, or at least the reports in the papers on the weekend suggesting that he might be going after a defense of saying, well, that's all very well, I might have done this stuff, but I didn't realize it was a criminal offense. Important point first is that is a valid defense in South African criminal law.
Oh, really? But wow, I didn't know that. I must remember that the next time I'm intentionally corrupt.
Well, The problem is you have to be pretty dumb to do so. So you're not going to get away with that. And it's going to be, look, it's a valid defense. But the difficulty that anybody faces when they raise this is to explain why it is that they chose to do it in dark alleys and receive their money in brown envelopes, in the middle of the night. So that's always the problem.
Can I pause there, Professor, with a question that I will self-declare to be a good one? Does that then mean that when someone says, "I promise you, James, I didn't intend to," that cannot be taken as definitive proof that they lacked an intention? How does the court go about determining what your intention must have been and in fact was, despite what you claim?
So because intention is all about what was actually going on inside the person's head at the relevant time, the courts are hamstrung. Nobody has access to what anybody was thinking. So what the prosecution then has to do is it has to lead evidence of objective facts from which a court can infer that the person must have known. And that's the key phrase here. The evidence that the prosecution puts before a court must enable a court to say there is no other conclusion that could possibly be reached other than you must have known. So it's an argument by inference. And what the prosecution will be doing is it will be looking for all of the types of evidence which would put the court in that position, such as, why was money being handed around in brown envelopes? Why was none of this being declared? Why do we find the accounts scribbled on the back of somebody's old cigarette box? These sorts of things would assist a court in ultimately arriving at the necessary inference.
Okay. That makes sense. Okay, so one can look at the evidence then, and then on the basis of inferential logic, the court may be able to say, nope, you uttered the words, I did not intend. However, on balance, we don't think so.
Even it has to go further than on balance. It has to be, you know what, beyond a reasonable doubt, there is no other reasonable explanation than that you must have thought so. Because remember, the onus of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay.
I think because it's going to be sufficiently important going forward, if I can just refer people to the actual case, it's the case of de Blom, 1977, where the...
That's right.
The woman... So the woman in question, who was the accused, succeeded with one claim of mistake of law, but failed on the other. She succeeded in respect of a bunch of jewels that she was trying to exit the country with, but she was wearing them openly, and she'd forever worn a lot of jewelry and left the country and come back. No problem. Court said, we accept that you were mistaken in that respect. But please explain to us why, if you didn't know that it was a problem to take so much money in cash out of the country, why had you hidden it in your bag, lady? And she couldn't explain that. And that's exactly what the court's going to be looking for on this occasion.
Dumile, what is your question?
Hi, how are you, Sergius?
Extremely well.
Professor Grant, good afternoon. Just so I find out, people normally confuse the issue of counts and charges. What is the difference between counts and charges?
Excellent question, Dumile. I've been wanting to know myself, and some people who don't like legal journalists in particular, or journalists in general, they go, aha, we can't trust you guys. You've been saying 783 charges. Now we know you were wrong. What else are you wrong about? Well, let's set the record straight.
I don't lie awake at night worrying about the difference between those. In fact, I know of no dictionary in law that really distinguishes harshly between those two. But let me try and explain where I think the confusion is coming from. There seems to be 783 instances of improper payments that have been that were made to Jacob Zuma, and so there would be these instances which ultimately would form the basis on which the court would say, the prosecution would say to the court, he has done this so many times that overarching all of this, it must prove that he committed the crime of corruption. Whether we want to label anything a count or a charge, if you really feel the need, let me try and distinguish. If you go to the police station, you would probably be said to be laying a charge. When a prosecution formulates its charge sheet, you see, even a charge sheet is called a charge sheet, that thing that's presented to an accused and used in court. In that thing, the various charges are referred to as counts.
Mm. Okay, that seems to make sense to me as well. Let's take a bit of a break there, and then we're going to have more with Professor James Grant in a moment. What questions do you have for him? I still want to know the differences between corruption, money laundering, and racketeering, and what do you have to prove in all those other cases. But some fascinating insights so far. Give us a call, 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg, and in Cape Town, 021-446-0567.
CBS Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
27 minutes before noon. James?
Yes, sir.
I don't know whether I lost concentration. Did you tell us what racketeering is?
No, you're such a lawyer. You noticed that I didn't answer your question. So, let's start with corruption, if I may, and I will get to racketeering. So, corruption, of course, is the improper receipt or acceptance of some sort of benefit. In that respect, it's an improper in, if we can refer to it as that, in combination with some sort of improper out, a promise to influence something, a promise to award, for instance, a tender where it's not due, a promise to decide something in a particular way. So really, corruption amounts at the bottom line to an improper in and an improper out, those two together, intentionally done, right? Mm. Then racketeering is where you have, over a period of time, engaged in a series of offenses, and they can be pretty much anything. There's a list which should have rather been a list of what's excluded, because pretty much everything is included, which certainly extends to corruption. And when we say you have engaged in a series can constitute simply two or more of a series of particular offenses would make you guilty of racketeering. And they could, of course, also be a combination of, say, fraud and corruption. So really you're looking at crimes which are aimed, the crime of racketeering is aimed at syndicates where they get together and over time engage perpetually in one or other type of crime. And the suggestion here is that there was exactly this sort of syndicate set up between Sheikh and Zuma.
Oh, then, okay.
Something worth mentioning possibly is that very severe penalties for racketeering, the legislation provides up to a maximum of 30 years in prison for that. Then the other relevant one is fraud, which I expect will be less important and possibly charged as an alternative here. Fraud is really where, again, you intentionally misrepresent something which has the effect of causing someone else to act to their prejudice. So what could have been the misrepresentation? For instance, misleading Parliament, misleading State Treasury, misleading SARS, so that ultimately you benefited in some way and that institution or person acted to their prejudice. SARS, for instance, didn't get their pound of flesh.
Mm. Okay, that seems to make sense to me. Money laundering?
Okay. Money laundering, the idea there is to catch somebody who is trying to hide the source of funding. Mm. So if, and the concern there is obviously that if there's going to be somebody stealing money or somebody defrauding another person, if you're going to be using the money, you would want to, well, the law enforcement agencies would need to be able to identify whether money is legitimately obtained or not. And where somebody engages in money laundering, it weakens the state's ability to enforce the other laws.
Okay. Polani, hello.
Hi, Eusebius. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Yes, also like to greet your guests in studio. I've got a question. You know, well, quite recently we've been hearing stories that, okay, the charges are not 700, and it seems as if they are instituting that oppositions are trying to make the story worse than it actually is. But my question is, even though it's 700 counts, it's not 700 charges, doesn't that play a big effect, especially when it comes to sentencing? And how much weight does that actually hold once he's found guilty and when he has to be sentenced? Do they go back to saying, no, it's so many charges, so we're going to disregard how many times he did it and just give him sentence based on the normal basic sentencing procedure, or do they actually take into account that it was done so many times?
Okay, good question. Put differently, as we say on Twitter, is a lot.
Yes, excellent question, because the caller is absolutely right. The ultimate effect of this is going to be on sentencing. There is a debate as to where somebody, for instance, engages in, let's call it, 783 occasions on which they receive an improper payment. Could they be charged with 783 counts of corruption? The answer is technically yes, but there's a rule in our law which says that we prefer, or the law ought not to punish a person for the same conduct. And where it's the same thing committed within a fairly short period of time, our law tends to treat that as one instance. But it will, of course, be informed by the fact that there were so many instances of improper payments as evidence toward the ultimate conclusion that there was corruption. So I expect that what's happening in this case is that all of these are being taken together to prove effectively one large crime of corruption. And as the caller has said very correctly, the fact that there were so many improper payments will influence sentence.
Hmm. Can he say, okay, I guess you have finally got me in the docks, but right to speedy trial? No, 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 no.
Certainly, there are provisions in the Constitution, and those have been taken up and given expression to in the Criminal Procedure Act, which say you have the right to a speedy prosecution. However, the case law around that has been fairly clear that if the reason why you are only facing the court sort of 10 years later is because you have been clawing tooth and nail to stay out of court, then, sorry, you don't get to make that argument.
Okay, that makes complete sense. Lesego, quick one, what is your question? Okay, we don't have Lesego there, so I'm going to put my next question. Shabir Sheikh has already been found guilty of corruption. It takes two to tango. Can that case just be dragged into this one so that it is over in 5 minutes?
Very good question, except that tangoing is not the crime. So the so because of the crime requires not only that you've done something wrong, but that you were thinking the wrong thing at that same time. That wasn't considered in the Sheikh trial, at least not in respect of Zuma.
Okay.
So that is what's going to be an issue here. And you can see already that it seems to be where Zuma is aiming his defense, because he seems to be saying already, I didn't have intention. He's putting his mental state in question, which wasn't decided in the Sheikh trial.
Okay. Okay, well, I suppose that makes sense. So in the unlikely event that you were to give free advice to Jacob Zuma and Michael Hulley, from a strategy point of view, what is his best bet to be focusing, as you and I have done in this little workshop on intention, or are there other parts of the overall legal strategy, or the tactics rather, in the toolkit that avail themselves?
I think in terms of strategy on the substantive issues, it seems as if he's going in the direction which is what I think is the only thing available to him, which is to deny the required mental state, to deny that he either understood on a factual level that these things amounted to, for instance, benefits that he was receiving, or that some sort of influence was required from him on the other hand. And even if that's all proved, so that it's proved that he actually did know this stuff, then to go with the argument that he just didn't know that he was doing wrong in criminal law.
Bonus question, because you're a superstar.
What
happens if Sean gets dismissed, or doesn't get dismissed, but loses the case to try and continue on as the head of the NPA? Can Zuma turn on his former BFF and bring yet another attempted stay of prosecution, I almost said execution, by then arguing that any decision that Sean had taken must be void, to use pretentious Latin, up initio, because Sean was not lawfully in a position to take a decision?
I think it's going to be a tough one, by virtue of the fact that so many courts have now considered the reason to prosecute and have effectively stamped that as rational. So to try and challenge a decision not to withdraw as irrational is really, really going to be an uphill battle. But I do want to add the caveat here that none of us are privy or have knowledge of what it was that was contained in the new representations. And let's imagine that in those new representations, it included a letter from, let's say, Thabo Mbeki to say, yes, Jacob, thanks for telling me that these people all are offering you money and that they want you to do this stuff. It's perfectly fine with us. And there's also attached a copy of some meeting with the ANC in which the minutes seem to indicate that this was all given the stamp of approval. Now, if that's the sort of thing that he can produce, a decision to prosecute could be, or to continue to prosecute, could be questionable. Mm. We just don't know.
Fascinating. Fascinating. James, is it too late to get into your online class?
Not at all.
How
Everyone
do I do
welcome.
That?
Online at jamesgrant.co.za.
Thanks, Prof.
Thank you.